Hey, welcome back to a main episode on Till I Say It Out Loud. I am processing through and talking through one of my favorite true crime stories today that is the basis of a few horror films that I did not realize. So I explain a little bit more after our little interlude, our little theme song, but that's what you're in for today. So enjoy. I was really interested in doing like weirder stories that aren't often discussed, or if they are discussed, like take a different direction with them. Just things that maybe aren't as often highlighted. So I was like, what are some weird things that I'm like interested in? And I'm super into true crime. And so I was like, okay, everyone has a true crime podcast. Everyone discusses true crime to some, like in some capacity. Like everybody probably has like one true crime podcast they already subscribe to if they're into true crime, if not multiple. And I was like, okay, well, I don't want to do too much true crime. But what if I go to Ranker and see if there's like a weird list that like takes me down a rabbit hole? So what I found was a Ranker list that is called Disturbing Movies Loosely Based on Actual Crimes. And so most of them, like I knew, I went through the list. Number one was Silence of the Lambs, obviously. They talk a lot about Ed Gein being like the inspiration for Buffalo Bill, but don't mention that him pretending to be hurt to lure his victims into the van was actually based on Ted Bundy, but whatever. Anyways, sometimes I know more than a list that I read because I'm that into true crime. But anyways, so they have stuff like that, like Three Billboards obviously is based on an actual case. Fargo is based on an actual case, et cetera, et cetera. So I was scrolling through and I was just like, okay, I kind of know all these. And you know how you can kind of be a dick about it when you get on a listicle that's like 10 things you missed in the last episode of whatever. I'm like, oh yeah, try me. And so I'll look and be like, I know those things. You can't tell me. Well, I got to The Stepfather, which is a horror movie series from the 80s. And I was like, okay, I've never seen these. And I remember hearing about them. I was very young when these movies came out. I was just like, okay, well, I don't know about what this is, so let me check in. Well, the blurb talks about how this character, the stepfather, was based on a man named John List. And I immediately was like, oh my God, because that was one of the most interesting cases to me because it's so cinematic. When I first heard about it on My Favorite Murder, and then I went back and realized I had seen this story on an old episode of Forensic Files. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that they based that movie on this story that I thought was so interesting. So what I'm going to bring to you today is I'm going to talk about the story of John List. He is a family annihilator. And then, and his absolutely cinematic story of like escape and capture. Then in part two, I'm going to talk about the movies, The Stepfather, and how they connect to the true story of John List. If you are a true crime person, you might probably already know this whole thing. I'm trying to bring some research in that I haven't heard on other podcasts or like in the Forensic Files. I re-listened to a few podcasts. My Favorite Murder, do one of my favorite coverages of the case. It's really well done by Karen in Georgia, and it's very early. I think it was the 29th episode. I rewatched the John List episode of Forensic Files. It's in series one, episode 12. So very, very early. It actually aired in 1996, which is incredible. Like it's nearly 30 years old. My God. I'm just so old now. But yeah, it is such a good episode of Forensic Files too. But if you watch it having never seen it or seen Forensic Files, just be ready. It is a very old, it's a very old show. Very interesting. And I also read through this incredible website called Nightmare Houses, and it deep dives the history of the house where this happened, because the house plays, to me, a huge role in why this story is so uniquely eerie and upsetting. John List was able to elude the FBI for 18 years after he committed the crimes I'm going to tell you guys about. And another thing to know about Forensic Files from the early 90s especially is, if you do watch it, they have really bad B-roll, but had absolutely no problem of showing full-on crime scene photos, just like in the first 25 seconds of any episode. So they fully show crime scene photos. I guess in the 90s, that was like not something they considered to be, it was like primetime television, or like maybe this is when adults are watching, so it's like fine. Like, and so they fully show murder, like crime scenes. And in this case, they might have censored others. In this case, they did not censor these, because they just were like, these are the victims. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot. Anyway, so just be aware of that. Let's start with John List's background. As I said, he was a family annihilator. And as a family annihilator, they have a very specific like pathology. They have a very specific pattern. And in this case, List was abused as a child. He had very strict German parents. And his father was described as an authoritarian, very overbearing, and his mother was very overbearing as well, domineering, and just very much like the type of discipline that is authoritarian. So you can imagine, as a child growing up, you probably didn't feel like you had much power. This is common in family annihilators, because when they finally have their own families, they feel like they finally have like hold power. And so any loss of power within that dynamic can make them snap, even if they never have seemed like that kind of person before, which usually, again, is a pattern of the family annihilator. Another example of that would be the man Chris Watts, who seemed very mild-mannered and very kind of like introverted and just happy with his family. And then one day, snapped, murdered his pregnant wife, murdered his two daughters. Horrible, horrible case. But that's kind of the pattern that we see with these kinds of people. And they generally are always, they're generally men. They're usually the husband. Obviously, there are female family annihilators. I am thinking of a very specific example, and I can't think of the names of the ladies, but they were a lesbian couple who adopted children, and they were very abusive. One of the young boys was from a viral photo hugging a police officer, I think, during like some protests years ago. And he was adopted by these mothers with the rest of his siblings. And it turned out that they were very abusive, racist, and they were starving these poor children. And before anyone could do anything, the two mothers drove them off a cliff. And it's just like one of the saddest stories. So usually it's a father figure as a family annihilator, but that obviously isn't true in every case. And unfortunately, I can name a few examples on either side. The young man's name who was the victim of the crime that I just described was called Devontae Hart. And he was in a photo holding a sign for free hugs and was hugging a police officer. And it was said that it seemed like it was against his will. He was crying, but a lot of people took it to be like a heartwarming image. And after the background of this story of this family came out, it was discovered that he was often used as a prop for his adopted mothers to get clout online. A very low percentage of family annihilators kill themselves. In the case that I just mentioned, obviously that woman killed herself and her partner and her adopted children. But like I mentioned, Chris Watts, he did not kill himself. He was caught, arrested, and taken to jail. And as we're going to see, John List does not take his own life. He takes the life of his family and then goes on the run to try to make a new life for himself. He is a total dick, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. So eventually, John List, he grows, he gets his own family, he marries his wife, Helen. So what happens with Helen, and I learned this, so I didn't know some of these things before I did a little bit further research into List's past, but Helen had a husband who she had married before, and she had talked bad about him. She was kind of I don't want to say she was a loose cannon, but she was kind of always talking shit, you know, because that'll be an issue with her and John later. But she had talked bad about her first husband and his performance in bed. That was like something she would do. Like she would get drunk and she had like an alcohol problem. And so like she might say stuff like that. So I always assumed that she had divorced her first husband. Actually, he died in Korea in the war. So in November of 1950, she buried her first husband and met John List the next day at a bowling alley in Virginia while she was like out with her sister. So I was like, oh, so she talked shit on him, but he died. I just assumed she had divorced him, but she didn't seem to be too tore up about losing her first husband because she was like next day, like chilling with John List. And they got married in Maryland, Helen and John List, just 3 months after meeting. So again, she didn't seem too tore up about losing her first husband because he was in the ground just 3 months or so and she was married to the next guy. Another thing about her, this is huge, I feel is maybe a contributing factor as to why she was a loose cannon in some regard, is she had untreated syphilis. Well, I'm trying to piece it together. I imagine maybe she contracted. I don't want to say this on this poor man. It might not be true. I'm speculating, but perhaps she contracted syphilis from her ex-husband because he cheated. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how she contracted syphilis. I had looked it up, but she had it when she met John and she had it when she married John. It went unknown, like undetected, because you could get a marriage license back in that time without doing blood tests. And so it just like kind of flew under the radar. So she had untreated syphilis that was obviously getting worse as time wore on, because you can't leave that untreated. A little bit more about Helen. She apparently was an unstable alcoholic and just was known to publicly humiliate and insult John List often. So I don't know. Maybe their courtship should have been a little longer and they maybe shouldn't have ended up together. But she also talked shit about how bad List was in bed as well. So that kind of seemed to be like a pattern with her, like, oh, he can't satisfy me in bed, and like kind of publicly humiliate her husband for whatever reason. And this kind of overbearing nature, psychologists kind of will speak towards later in the trial, that this might have reminded List of his mother, who obviously he had issues with. So let's talk about the murder house, Breeze Knoll. Breeze Knoll may be one of the most beautiful names of a house I've ever heard. It bums me out so much that something so heinous took place there. Also, the house is no longer stands, so it doesn't even exist anymore. But it was a sprawling 19-room mansion. It was in New Jersey. I have the address. This is so fantastic. So nightmarehouses.com. God love them. I love a scary house. I love an old, beautiful, haunted house. This is so cool. So Nightmare Houses has where the address used to be. It was 431 Hillside Avenue in Westfield, New Jersey. And it was built in 1896. So it was like this beautiful Georgian style, classic colonial style Georgian feature, like sea captain style home. And it was 3 stories high. And this website said that it was built on the highest hill in town. So it was probably kind of, people probably were able to like point to it and be like, oh, that's Breeze Knoll. There's a big, large yard, Palladian windows, oak flooring, 10 fireplaces in this place, some of which were made of marble, which is like, I'm just picturing this place must be so beautiful and gorgeous and haunted. There were 5 bathrooms, 2 living rooms, a butler's pantry on the first floor. And then there was this like stained glass skylight in the ballroom. So there's a ballroom too. And I have measurements here that it's like 33 feet by 20 feet. Stained glass skylight. I don't know if that's accurate, but I know that it was supposed to be worth like a bunch of money. So that, I mean, it would have to be really, really big for it to be worth what I've read that it was worth like $100,000. So that's just, this house is just incredible. In 1905, there was a art and book collection that was kept in the ballroom. And in the third floor, there was a servant's quarter. And that's important for later. We're going to talk about who actually lived up there. But it's like its own space. So there's like it's three floors. It's beautiful. It can house, honestly, so many people. And then on the top floor is like its own little apartment. And then it had an imperial staircase that split into two. So it came down into two different staircases. It just sounds beautiful. It's so beautiful. So the family who owned it were called the Witkeys. And there was like 3 generations of them that lived in this house starting in like 1896. And I was reading through Nightmare Houses thinking, because I already thought like the List family is going to move into the house and we know, I'm going to tell you what happens to the house, but they move in the 70s. And so I was like, the way I've always heard this house described, I was like, there has to be like more to this house because it's so like gorgeous and historical feeling. I'm like, it had to have been haunted before any of this stuff happened, because like there's no way in a house that's that old, that historical, has never had anybody pass away in it. So actually Nightmare Houses did the work for me, and they actually said that in January 1920, an 87-year-old woman, Mrs. Phoebe Witke, did die in the house of old age, I think. She was a resident. She lived there at the time. And then 16 years later, another resident died, John Witke. He fell down the grand staircase and fractured his skull. And he died in the house 2 hours later. So someone passed away because they lived there. Someone had a freak accident and died there. But in 1965, the Witke grandchildren sold the mansion to a family that was new to town, John and Helen List, with their children. I said they moved in the 70s. They move into the 60s and the crime happens in the 70s. So that's the house. And that's kind of the history of the house. The Witkeys lived in this house for like 70 years. Yeah, 70 years. And they sold it out of the family to John List. And the following happens. So the next part of my notes is called The List Family Unraveling. And it speaks towards why John List felt that he had no options but to do what he did. And it speaks towards what caused him in his weird family annihilator brain to make the decisions that he does. John and Helen List, when they move into this house, have 3 children. Patricia, who is the oldest, she's 16 years old. John Jr., who is the middle child, he's 15 years old. And I think it was Forensic Files that said John was his favorite, which I'm interested when I hear details like that. I'm like, I wonder why. I mean, he named this child after him, but I'm like, whoa, what was wrong with the other two? And then their youngest was named Freddie, and he was 13 years old. And then his mother, John List's mother, Elma, lived on the third floor. And so the servants' quarter that I was talking about being kind of its own space, that was actually Elma's like house, like a little apartment up there. They kind of made it her own space. So his overbearing wife, his overbearing mother live in the house with him. And then he has these 3 children who are growing up and entering the 70s, especially Patricia as a 16-year-old girl entering the 70s, like they're starting to push boundaries. They're starting to be teenagers. So this was part of it. Also, List was a devout Lutheran and taught Sunday school at his church. So this man's wound pretty tight from what we know of his family, like growing up. And now we're understanding like his religious upbringing. He was a Boy Scout leader. He was a bank president or accountant. I read both, but I know that he was also comptroller. He took himself pretty seriously, I think. But he ended up getting fired from his jobs. And this is going to be a pattern with List, that he, because of quote unquote personality problems, that led him to only staying in one job a few years at a time before being fired and having to move on. And so you can imagine this is a lot of pressure for him and like a lot of humiliation for him. And then the kind of dynamic he seems to have with Helen, that would probably like ramp up the tension with Helen. And just as you can tell, this is not a great like recipe for happy family. By 1971, you know, they moved in 1965. And so by the sixth year of living in that enormous house, which, if you remember how I described it, a man who cannot keep a job, like how in the world is he handling this house? But by 1971, List had sold most of the furniture in the home and had a car he was not able to get inspected because he couldn't even afford to get it inspected. And so he was skimming money off the top of his mother's account to try to make it by, trying to see if he could, you know, get that under the radar. And that money was nearly almost gone. So the tension, the pressure is just woo, right at the tippy top of boiling over with this. And so once he lost his job, you know, obviously he can't bring himself. This is obviously a huge problem. And so he can't bring himself to tell his wife and his mother that he failed again. And can't bear that. And so instead he pretends to be going off to work for weeks after he was fired instead of telling his family. He would go into the town. He would read paper all day, just like sit and read the paper all day. And then he'd come home and pretend that he was at work, which is it's so creepy to me. And so it was just incredible feeling of losing control at this point, seeing his children growing and kind of testing limits and finding their individuality, losing his job while the bills are piling up and Helen, you know, always complaining and mom's there. It's just a whole thing, losing authority over his kids. And I think at one point I in each of the places I read about List, it said specifically about his daughter, Patricia, who was starting to be interested in acting, and List thought that that was a sinful avenue for her to go down. You know, not like murdering your whole family. Acting is the bad thing. So, okay. So we're to the crime itself. On November 9th, 1971, List woke up and he went into the kitchen and his wife was sitting at the kitchen table drinking her morning coffee, and List shot Helen in the back of the head and it went into the back cabinet. Like the bullet went into the back cabinet behind her. Okay. So then he went up to the third floor of the beautiful Breeze Knoll to his mother's apartment and killed her, shot her right over her left eye, face to face. People speculate later that the reason we're almost certain that he had issues with his mother is this. Like, he will shoot every other one of his victims in the back of the head, but mom was face to face and right over her eye. I don't know. I feel like he hated her. Next thing he does is he drags Helen into the ballroom and cleans up a bit. And then waits. He leaves his mom upstairs. She's too heavy to carry. He will write that in a letter later. But he waits all day after he kills his wife and his mother for his kids to come home one by one so he can finish his plan. So his daughter arrives first, then his youngest. Both are shot in the back of the head. Now John Jr. is a different situation, and this is a very, very sad part. I mean, all of it's very sad because John List is a piece of shit, but this is very, very sad. So apparently John Jr. had a soccer game that afternoon. And so while the rest of his family lies dead in the List house, he kills them, drags them into the ballroom, except not mom. She's not invited to the ballroom. List drives to the school to watch his favorite son's soccer match. And then when they arrive home together, that is when he kills his oldest son, who is allegedly his favorite. And he ends up having to shoot this poor child 10 times. So they speculate, based on the wounds, that he might have seen it coming. I assume it would be really difficult to hide what you're doing when you're not sneaking up on John Jr. You're arriving home after a soccer match with him. So it seems that Jr. tried to fight back or to escape, but he was unable to. And he seemed to be the only family member to fight back. And that's why his murder was messier. So after that, again, John drags the body to the ballroom. And he's laying each of them on a sleeping bag. And after that, he drives to the bank. He closes his and his mother's account. He lets the carpool in town know that they won't be needing to carpool anymore because he and the family are going to head to North Carolina. He cancels the milk delivery. If you didn't know, people used to have milk delivered like to the front door. It's quaint. So he thought that was important. Canceled the milk delivery, canceled the newspaper, and went to the post office to hold the mail. We're going on a trip. Just hold the mail. And then he returns home and he's done all that, murdered his family. So he makes dinner and he goes upstairs to write a letter. And he composes multiple letters, like one to his pastor, one to the original owners of the house, so like the Witkeys, and then a few other people. And he dates it November 9th, 1971. And this is to his pastor. I'm going to read exactly what he wrote in the first line or so. It just to give you guys an idea of like the mental gymnastics this man can do to do what he's done and still be able to address his pastor. It says, "Dear Pastor Renwinkle, I'm very sorry to add this additional burden to your work. I know what has been done is wrong from all I have been taught, and that any reason I might give will not make it right. But you are the only person I know who, while not condoning this, will understand why I felt I had to do this." So if I'm the pastor reading this, I'm offended that this man thought I would side with him. He's like, I would be like, "It me? Like, you thought you could tell me that you murdered your family?" And I would be like, "I see where he's coming from." Like, that would piss me off if I was Pastor Renwinkle. So he goes on to say in this letter, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll kind of get into the key elements that explain why he does this, because apparently he needed people to understand. List says that he was afraid to go on welfare. And he was also worried that his daughter's interest in acting was sending them all down the wrong path of like moral decay. And he believed that it was better that they die now and go to heaven than to live on and turn down a sinful path and eventually live a life that they choose for themselves, but possibly die later and go to hell. So he basically was killing them to save their like immortal souls in whatever kind of weird mental gymnastics he was able to come to that conclusion. So he details the murders in the letters. Liz says in the letter that the 70s is a sinful time. And I think one of the experts on Forensic Files said that in his mind, List killed his family to save their souls. So it was about, in his mind, that was his explanation. I don't know if List actually believed that. I think that was a really nice way to write a letter about why he did it, a nice way to explain away why he did it. But I think he just was like, "This sucks. I want to start over." And so he did it. I think it was just selfishly motivated. I don't think he really cared about their souls. He said he spared himself suicide because suicide is a mortal sin and would have barred him from heaven. So he stayed alive so he could repent for his murders. It's really strange how people in certain religions and certain denominations like think salvation is like transactional. It's like very strange. Like, oh yeah, I'll just like check these boxes, and then I'll check these boxes, and it's fine. I can murder my family and then I'll just repent, and I won't kill myself. I'll spare myself that so that I have time to repent. So I did them a favor and sent them to heaven, and then I'll do myself a favor in life by repenting, and then I'll get to go to heaven. Like, it's so crazy to me. I'm just like, dude, no, like, it's not how it works. Anyways, okay. I mean, I don't know how it works, but I really feel like it can't be that. Okay, anyways. So one of the lines in his letter, which is baffling to me, it's insane. He says, it was only done after much thought. So right there, admitting to extreme premeditation, but also just like basically trying to justify it by being like, I did it because I had to. So he has to go into, and this is why I think he might also be like kind of narcissistic. And forgive me if I'm throwing around terms and you feel that it's incorrect. But maybe if you hear this next part, you'll kind of see where I'm coming from. But he had to defend, like he had to counter a possible claim people would make if they heard about the story, by saying, many may think it's cowardly to shoot from behind, but it was to save them from fear, he says. And I wrote, sure, Jan. But I just think it's really interesting that he needed to write in his letter, you know, don't think I'm a coward. Like, I shot them in the back of the head for their sake, not because I'm a coward. I just feel like needing to clarify that so people don't think you're a coward, that's pretty ego-driven, right? So later the jury would be shocked to hear the final line of the letter, which was an afterthought. It was just like a PS. And so he writes this whole letter, and it's very well written. It's very beautifully stated, despite everything being in it, like complete wackadoo. And then at the very end, he goes, PS, mother is upstairs. She was too heavy to move. Gasp across the courtroom. Silence. Like, dude, that's your mom. Like, really messed up. Another reason why people are certain that he had huge issues with his mother. So after he writes this letter, and this is the part that I think is the most psychotic, and I feel like this is something that Karen on My Favorite Murder pointed out too, that was so frightening. And it's very cinematic, which I'm not going to talk about the Stepfather movies yet, but I really wish they would have added this element into the movies. It would have made it so much scarier. But what Liss then goes around the house to do is he goes and he cuts himself physically out of every single photo in the home with a pair of scissors, and then disposes of the clippings. Like, that is so frightening. And when you hear it, you might think that is spooky. But if you consider the time period, like, those are kind of the only photos of him. So once he gets rid of them, they're going to have a harder time finding him. So it was actually really smart. Then he feeds his son's pet fish, which is, again, just deranged. And that then goes to sleep. He sleeps in the house where he had murdered his entire family as their bodies lay cold downstairs in the ballroom. It is just chilling, the amount of dissonance this man has from the humanity of his own family. So before he leaves the next day, he cleans up a little bit more. And then Breeze Knoll will stand empty for an entire month with only the dead inside. Because the family didn't socialize much, it wasn't noticed that they were not coming and going or anything was weird for a literal month. It was like just short of 4 weeks that someone started to notice. And this other part, this is another part that I think is so cinematic and so freaking creepy that I, again, wish they would have added this into the Stepfather series, and they didn't. And that's okay. But this is a really incredible detail. It wasn't until light bulbs in the lamps that Liszt had left on throughout the house started burning out one by one did people start realizing that something was going on. Like, every night, I just got a shudder. So like every night they'd see the lights on in this house and be like, okay, weird. Go to bed, maybe wake up, sun's up. They don't notice the lights are still on. Sun goes down, lights are on. They're like, okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, go to sleep. wake up, maybe don't notice. Then the next night they see, oh, the lights are on, but not that one. And then the same thing the next night. And then maybe a few days later, another one goes out. And then pretty soon they start seeing, wait a second, are these lights on all the time? And so then finally they start picking up on it being weird. It's just so eerie to me. It's terrifying. Patricia's precious theater teacher was the one who was most suspicious of this trip, this like trip to North Carolina or South North Carolina. Patricia had originally said to him, if anything ever happens to us, Dad killed us. To me, if I'm that theater teacher, I mean, I know what it's like to be a teacher now. We are a required reporter of like child abuse now. At this time, I don't know what the policies were, but if it were me, I might go, ooh, Patricia, is everything okay at home? And I might have to like make a report if I heard a child say that. But it was like, it's like good for him for kind of being having his ear peaked for that kind of stuff, because he's the one who was like, we're going to go figure out, like, let's go over there and see what's going on. So on December 7th, 1971, the corpses in the ballroom were discovered. As police entered, there was religious organ music being played over the intercom. So before Liz left, for whatever godforsaken reason, he thought it was appropriate to turn on music to play throughout the house. And apparently it was the kind, like, it would play until someone turned it off. So it was playing for a month to an empty house, only filled with these poor dead bodies. And so the police are like entering this crime scene, and there's this eerie religious organ music being played over the intercom. So Liz's mother was found upstairs, Elma, on the third floor, as I said. And then the others were found in the ballroom, as I said, on sleeping bags. And then Liz's car was found in a JFK airport parking lot. But since he had had a month's head start, and it was unclear if he had taken a plane or taken a train, the trail was already cold. So it was like, well, damn, what do we do? And because there were no credible photos left behind, it was really hard to start a manhunt. But the FBI made this a high priority case, and they were after him like all over the country. And then our forensic files said that there were tips of Liz sightings like all over the place. People were seeing him everywhere. But he evaded them, as I said at the beginning, for 18 years after that. So he left and did all that weird stuff, and then hit the road. And for 18 years, he was gone. The next part of my notes is called List Caught. And America's Most Wanted is going to play a major role in his capture. And this is some of the cinematic parts of this story do not end with how he executed the murder. It goes on into how they were able to track him down. It's just so incredible. And it's a very satisfying capture. So let's talk about that. So in 1989, America's Most Wanted airs a special on List. They invite a man named Frank Bender, who is a forensic artist, to come on this episode. And he was a reconstruction artist. So what his talent was he would recreate like face, like the way face would look on top of a skull shape to help identify victims. So if they had found remains and they had like, and they were maybe vastly decomposed, there was like no way to identify them, then he would, I'm touching my own face like you guys can see me, but he would take the skull and he would measure the dimensions, and then he would take information from the DNA where it was like, what's the ethnicity or the race or like, you know, that kind of stuff. And then he would reconstruct the face over the skull to look like what it might look like. And one of the photos, I'm going to put the photo in the carousel for this episode. One of the things that Frank Bender did was he helped identify, I think it was like a young, it was like a 7 to 10 year old black child. And she, like, he reconstructed the way she looked, like her face over the skull that he had, just based on like DNA and like knowing she was a young black girl and all these things. And they show the photo of what he was able to sculpt. He was a sculptor. And then who they identified her this way by using his bust, and what her, a photo of her. And it looked just like her. It's just incredible what this man was able to do. And so they were like, okay, well, what if we backwards engineer this and we do something similar, but it's to catch this awful family annihilator who like ran away from us. So they invite Frank Bender on to see if he could create a bust of List aged 18 years from that time. Bender took List's old photo, because there was a photo in like the church directory. And so if you don't know what John List looks like, he's just a regular like white dude, slicked back hair, and these like kind of like bottle rim glasses from the 60s. You can tell it's like late 60s when he had this photo taken. And that's what they used with their artist. And so Bender took that photo, and based on a psychological profile that they had a profiler on, he started to come up with what he would look like. And so based on that, he had a good idea of how Liz specifically might age because of habits that he might have and how he might take care of himself or not take care of himself. So through Bender's research, his strict upbringing, the Lutheran church, him being an only child. So he must, if he had authoritarian parents and they were Lutheran and he was the only child, like, I feel like he must have been very, very, very had very little control when he was young. Yeah, son of an overprotected, domineering mother who lacked social skills and had a history of losing jobs. He killed out of anger and retaliation for his own failures, feeling entrapped by women. This is all directly from the psychological profile that Bender used. So Bender took in photos of List's father and mother as well, in order to cover genetics, as well as looking at that photo that they had of List himself. And he even aged a scar on List's neck on the bust. So he included like that one little thing. And so he looked at List's father, who grew little jowls underneath his little chin as he aged. And so he gave List those, assuming that because he resembled his father, he would probably age like his father. And lastly, Bender believed that List would wear glasses like he did before, that he wouldn't want to get contacts ever because he would want to still be able to hide behind his glasses, but that he would maybe wear a different style than like the kind that he had in the church directory photo. And so he picked out these dark, thick frames because he believed these dark, thick frames would be something that List could wear to hide behind and hide from his failures. I just love the way that Bender, like, they talk about this part because it's fascinating. This ends up working. It was his old neighbors from Denver, Colorado, who recognized him. Her name was Wanda Flannery and her daughter. They were watching together and they saw their former friend on the television. And they said it was like looking right at him. And specifically the jowls that Bender had added from his father and those glasses. And so List was discovered in Virginia, and he said that he was even watching the show that night with his wife, and "I was perspiring like anything" is a quote. I think Karen Kilgariff on My Favorite Murder might have said that kind of like I just did. I just think the way she delivered it is so funny. I think that would be so funny to hear him go, I was perspiring like anything. Well, I bet you were, you crazy mother. Anyways, but he says his wife didn't recognize him. And so he thought maybe he would made it by, but he did not. He changed his name to Robert Peter Clark. And so when Wanda and her daughter were watching, they were like, "Oh my God, that's Bob." And they were able to use the scar and his fingerprints to prove that he was actually John List. The glasses that List wore were the exact same as those chosen by Bender for the bust. And guys, if you know the story, you know that that is like the ending that's like so satisfying and so fascinating. Like, art catches the bad guy
after 18 years, like amazing. And just like people coming together, watching a crime show that is literally based on, if you see this, help us catch him. And they did. Like, it's just such a satisfying ending to capture him. But if you see the bus next to him, it is uncanny. This Bender is an incredibly talented artist, and he is really changed so many lives by helping to find victims and identify victims and catch this awful man. So at trial, the prosecution claimed that List wanted a new start and nothing else. And that's what I believe. I do not believe that I don't believe any of the bull that he said about, oh, he's trying to save their soul. Like, I really just think that that sounded cute. I don't think that he felt that at all. He caught his family off guard one by one, shot them in the head, dragged them into the ballroom, cleaned up. And that, you know, like, it was very clinical. Like, it was very methodical. And he had such to sleep in the same house where you killed your family, knowing that four of them are downstairs and one of them is upstairs, and you're like, you sleep like a baby, you just sleep. That's disgusting. So apparently List had prayed over their bodies and then written the confession letter, which I think is even more insane, because how are you going to murder your family and then say a prayer over them? Like, sir, you need to go take a nap. That's ridiculous. Okay. He had also turned the air conditioner down in the house to slow decay. So everything that he did was to try and buy himself more time. Like, this really truly had nothing to do about the soul and like heaven. Like, he really just wanted to start over and get away with this crime. And he did for a very long time. He eventually joined a new church, married someone new, who was the friend of Wanda, who ended up being the one who recognized List. And he started over. And the poor woman that he married maintained List's innocence until he was convicted on 5 counts of first-degree murder and got life in prison. I feel so bad for her. I mean, she really believed he was a good man. And like I was saying at the beginning, family annihilators usually do it like one time. It's like, this is situational. I did this. I had to get out, and now I'm moving on. And they have this kind of dissonance between the acts they committed and the person they're trying to become. They were just like, well, that was in my way of doing what I needed to do, what I wanted to do. Now that obstacle is gone, AKA I murdered everyone. And now I can start over and have the life I want. And so it's probably true that he didn't seem like a kind of person who could do this, because he did it because he felt backed into a corner. It says that psychologists theorized that Liz had most likely an obsessive compulsive personality disorder. So to him, he had two options: welfare or I can send my family to heaven. I obviously think that's ridiculous, but I guess in his mind, it's better to go to heaven, die and go to heaven, than to go on welfare. Don't forget, they chose a 19-room mansion to move into. It didn't have to be that way, but they had to move into Breeze Knoll for some god-awful reason and ruin that house, despite clearly not being able to afford anything. So under his father's authoritarian teachings and his very uptight upbringing, welfare was just not an option. And so he felt like he was rescuing his family, at least in his mind. I'm sure that's what he told himself to stroke his own ego. Like, what a martyr. I killed my own family to save them. Douchebag. This also helped him to avoid having to fix his own problems, and possibly it allowed him to seek a bit of revenge on his mother, who he clearly hated because he shot her right in the eye, or right above her eye. Without the bust that was created by Bender, John List would still be at large. He would have gotten away with it. It was solely this bust and Wanda seeing it and picking up the phone that was able to get List. So the aftermath of List going to jail, he died on March 21st, 2008. That's a long time. He was in jail. His body was not claimed by anyone at first, but eventually he was buried next to his mother. And if I was her, I would be mad. Like, get that boy away from me. He killed me. He shot me above my eye. 9 months after the deaths were discovered, around 3 a.m. one night, mysteriously, Bree's Knoll burned down. This part makes me so sad. And as Nightmare Houses points out, the sixth victim of this crime is Bree's Knoll, because since 1896, the house stood and harbored three generations of a family and was beautiful and lovely, maybe just a little haunted, you know, but was there and great. And in just 6 years, this is Nightmare Houses did such a good job talking about this. In just 6 years, List destroyed it. The stained glass Tiffany skylight, which was worth around $100,000, as I said, at the time, possibly could have covered the debt that List was in at the time, but this has not been substantiated. So there's rumors that this could have been true. I know Miami Favorite Murder likes to lean into this one. She said, it could be true, it could not, but I'm going to believe it. But I looked on Nightmare Houses and they said that there wasn't really anything to substantiate that claim, but it is interesting to think about that if he had just, like, I don't know, pried the window out and sold it, maybe he could have not killed his entire family. List did say at trial, "Sorry for the tragedy that happened," which I always think when killers say this kind of shit where they say, "Sorry it happened," not "Sorry I did it." Again, it strikes me as narcissistic, can't take any kind of responsibility for their actions. "Sorry that it happened." How did it happen? Who knows? Not me, but sorry about it. Like, that's bullshit. He also mentions, "Due to my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for the crimes." Due to your mental state, you don't deserve to have to take responsibility for it. Absolutely not, sir. The way he planned everything out perfectly is so insane. Like, it's so meticulous, methodical. Like, there's no way he was in a mental state that would make him unaccountable. He said very clearly in the letter that he did it only after thinking about it for a long time. It was extremely premeditated. It was extremely, like cleanly well executed, and he hit everything. He even told the milkman he didn't have to come by anymore. Like, he thought of everything. So there's no way his mental state meant that he should not be unaccountable for those crimes. And thankfully, he was held accountable for them. December 1972, the plot where Bree's Knoll had stood, just a few months after the house burned down, the plot was sold and a new house was built on the plot in 1974. So two years later after it burned down, a new house was built on the plot. So Bree's no longer exists, and there's a new, like, different house. Probably not a 19-room house, but probably something pretty. As I said, Bree's Knoll served three generations for decades. John List purchased it, abandoned it, and ultimately destroyed it in just 6 years. If not for List, the house may still be standing and known as possibly the Whitkey Estate in New Jersey. It just makes me so sad because I just think the house is so beautiful. Anyways, that is the end of the List story. And those poor children and those poor women were murdered by this absolute psycho. So in part two, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk through The Stepfather, which is the original movie that bases the main character, Jerry, played by Terry O'Quinn of Lost fame, which is why I decided to start with the originals. So in 1987, this movie was made. And then in 1989, The Stepfather 2 was made. And I watched that one too. And then in 2009, a remake of The Stepfather was made. And I watched that one as well. There is a Stepfather 3, but it doesn't have Terry O'Quinn in it, so I didn't watch that. But I'm going to talk through those movies. I'm going to talk through what I think about them. And I'm going to talk through the things in the movies that are based around John List and some of the things that we saw in his story as it played out. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you then.